This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. Let's start with a really simple question. When does an individual clapping become a round of applause? Is it two people? Is it 10 people? And how do those people signal to each other that we, as a group, approve? A round of applause is its own thing. It knows when to start, it knows when to stop. It's a natural example of when a lot of people come together as one. Shared expression springs up among people all the time. And that's what we're exploring today on the TED Radio Hour. The power of crowds.
How do you organize a group of individuals so that the output of the group is something coherent and of lasting value instead of just being chaos?
I believe we're actually in a period when society, faced with great challenges, made a seismic shift from individual getting and spending towards a rediscovery of collective good.
When it comes to the big, important things that we need to do together, are we just going to be a crowd of voices, or are we also going to be a crowd of hands?
TED is an acronym for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. It brings together some really smart people to share powerful ideas from the stage at a TED conference. On our program, we'll hear some of those TED Talks and discuss some big ideas with TED speakers and other guests. Let's begin with Clay Shirky.
Now that media is increasingly social, innovation can happen anywhere that people can take for granted the idea that we're all in this together. And so we're starting to see a media landscape in which innovation is happening everywhere and moving from one spot to another. That is a huge transformation.
Clay Shirky teaches about social media at New York University and wrote the book Here Comes Everybody, about the power of crowds. We're going to speak with Clay in just a few minutes, but first, let's continue listening to his 2009 TED Talk, How Social Media Can Make History.
The moment we're living through, the moment our historical generation is living through, is the largest increase in expressive capability in human history. There are only four periods in the last 500 years where media has changed enough to qualify for the label revolution. The first one is the famous one, the printing press. Movable type, oil-based inks, that whole complex of innovations that made printing possible and turned Europe upside down starting in the middle of the 1400s. Then a couple of hundred years ago, there was innovation in two-way communication, conversational media. First the telegraph, then the telephone. Slow text-based conversations, then real-time voice-based conversations. Then about 150 years ago, there was a revolution in recorded media other than print. First photos, then recorded sound, then movies, all encoded into physical objects. And finally, about 100 years ago, the harnessing of electromagnetic spectrum to send sound and images through the air, radio and television. This is the media landscape those of us of a certain age grew up with and are used to. But there's a curious asymmetry here. The media that's good at creating conversations is no good at creating groups, and the media that's good at creating groups is no good at creating conversations. If you want to have a conversation in this world, you have it with one other person. If you want to address a group, you get the same message and you give it to everybody in the group, whether you're doing that with a broadcasting tower or a printing press. That was the media landscape as we had it in the 20th century. And this is what changed. The internet is the first medium in history that has native support for groups and conversation at the same time. Whereas the phone gave us the one-to-one pattern, and television, radio, magazines, books gave us the one-to-many pattern, the internet gives us the many-to-many pattern. Right? For the first time, media is natively good at supporting these kinds of conversations. That's one of the big changes. The second big change, right, is that as all media gets digitized, the internet also becomes the mode of carriage for all other media, meaning that phone calls migrate to the internet, magazines migrate to the internet, movies migrate to the internet. And that means that every medium is right next door to every other medium. Right? Put another way, media is increasingly less just a source of information and is increasingly more a site of coordination. Because groups that see or hear or watch or listen to something can now gather around and talk to each other as well. Right? And the third big change, right, is that members of the former audience can now also be producers and not consumers. Every time a new consumer joins this media landscape, a new producer joins as well, because the same equipment, phones, computers, lets you consume and produce. That is a huge change. And it's still changing as the media becomes more social. It's still changing patterns, even among groups who know how to deal with the internet well.
I'm going to show my age on this, but you gave the four examples of how technology changed. I'm talking using technology in terms of the printing press, the way we communicate. Four big monumental shifts. And I thought back to, gosh, when I was a teenager, it was the telephone chat room that you could get all your friends together or people you didn't know, and you could all get on the phone and talk to each other. So why wasn't that the breakthrough?
Why wasn't that this? Right. So that wasn't this for a couple of reasons. Real time doesn't scale, right? You can't get hundreds of people into a phone chat room and have it work. Phone conversations can't easily be stored or searched or forwarded. So all of the things we take for granted about, I said something now, you read it 3 days from now, she reads it 3 months from now, somebody else finds it and reads it 3 years from now, that doesn't happen in phone chat rooms. And distance doesn't cost money on the internet. So even though you could have these small real-time audio groups, you couldn't have large non-real-time global groups. And it's that very flexibility of the internet as the underlying tool that makes for what Seb Piquet famously calls ridiculously easy group forming.
Clay, I want to follow up on a point you made high up in your talk. You said
these tools don't get socially interesting until they get technologically boring.
Right. Why is that?
You know, these are tools that change the user. These are tools that, because they affect how we think of ourselves in relation to others, it's not just like giving someone a better shovel where you just go and do all the old jobs you did with a shovel, but it works better. When people have a sense of themselves of being able to reach out and communicate with more people than they could fit in their living room, that is for most of us a novel experience, but it takes some getting used to. So the techies and the neophiles get excited when a shiny new tool shows up. But it's really when your mom takes it for granted that that's the moment at which you can actually start to see it change society, because it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm using this special internet thing, or I'm using this special email thing or a web thing. It's Facebook has actually become routine enough that I can take it for granted that I can use it to send a message. Email has become routine enough. That moment is really the moment of potential social change, because the bulk of a society will then have adopted these tools, gotten used to them, and be ready to use them in new ways.
You spent a good amount of your talk, Clay, discussing what was happening in China.
Yeah.
And this was in 2009. Mm-hmm.
Last May, China in the Sichuan province had a terrible earthquake, 7.9 magnitude, massive destruction in a wide area, as the Richter scale has it. And the earthquake was reported as it was happening, right? People were texting from their phones. They were taking photos of buildings. They were taking videos of buildings shaking. They were uploading it to QQ, China's largest internet service. They were Twittering it, right? There were people listening all over the world hearing this news. The BBC got their first wind of the Chinese quake from Twitter. Twitter announced the existence of the quake several minutes before the US Geological Survey had anything up online for anybody to view. The last time China had a quake of that magnitude, it took them 3 months to admit that it had happened. Right? Now, they might have liked to have done that here rather than seeing these pictures go up online, but they weren't given that choice because their own citizens beat them to the punch. Even the government learned of the earthquake from their own citizens rather than from the Xinhua News Agency. And within half a day, donation sites were up and donations were pouring in from all around the world. This is an incredible, coordinated global response. And the Chinese, then in one of their periods of media openness, decided that they were going to let it go, that they were going to let this citizen reporting flower. And then this happened. People began to figure out in the Sichuan province that the reason so many school buildings had collapsed, because tragically the earthquake happened during a school day, the reason so many school buildings collapsed is that corrupt officials had taken bribes to allow those buildings to be built to less than code. a citizen journalist, started reporting that as well. And there was an incredible picture. You may have seen it on the front page of the New York Times. A local official literally prostrating himself in the street in front of these protesters in order to get them to go away, essentially to say, we will do anything to placate you, just please stop protesting in public.
If citizens are the truth tellers, as you describe in the situation in China, what happens when the citizens are untruthful? Where's the accountability?
Right. So this is the great epistemological question about democracy, which is, in what people or mechanism do you vest the idea of truth? And there has always been this checks and balances problem. So I would never say that the citizens are the truth tellers. What I would say is citizens are now welcomed into the media environment. I think the recent upwelling in interest around this stuff, because in part of the James O'Keefe video, because of the Kony 2012 video, because of the Mike Daisy piece, that there is a conversation going on in which people are unable to reconcile. This is an emotionally resonant story that gets people to act, and this is a dry recitation of facts that no one would disagree with. And that conversation is not resolving itself in part because there is no way to resolve that conversation. If you say essentially everyone must be convinced before we will call a fact, then things like global warming will remain forever contentious. If you are not willing to say some degree of consensus has been reached and therefore we are going to act, even as there are still people who, for one reason or another, deny what we've taken to be proof. The sad dilemma, Richard Rorty, I think the philosopher, put it best. For any society, truth is whatever anybody declines to be arguing about at the moment. Once you expand participation to everybody, then everybody provides the checks and balances. The system has to operate isometrically enough so that no one person is given an unobstructed platform and can speak without having other people raise objections. And then you have to have some mode of arriving at consensus in that environment.
We're speaking with Clay Shirky about his 2009 TED Talk, How Social Media Can Make History. Coming up after the break, we'll hear more from Clay and how political campaigns have responded to the power of crowds. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
Historically, we have always overestimated the value of access to information, and we have always underestimated the value of access to each other. The first two protocols that were debuted were remote access to files and remote access to computers. But email turned out to be the first killer app. Within 3 months of bringing email onto the internet, it was 75% of the backbone traffic, because it turns out access to files and access to computers is incredibly boring compared to access to each other.
That's NYU professor Clay Shirky talking about how we are intuitively drawn to communicating with each other. Social media tools are providing new clout, new command for like-minded groups of people, as well as creative ways for all involved to collaborate. The power of those crowds, both real and virtual, is changing the way things get done in the world. The power of crowds is the subject of our program today. Let's listen to Clay Shirky on this very topic, speaking at TED in 2009 in a prescient talk called How Social Media Can Make History. We'll talk with Clay in just a few minutes.
We saw some of the most imaginative use of social media during the Obama campaign. And I don't mean most imaginative use in politics. I mean most imaginative use ever. And one of the things Obama did, the Obama campaign famously put up mybarackobama.com, mybo.com. And millions of citizens rushed in to participate and to try and figure out how to help. Right? An incredible conversation sprung up there. And then, this time last year, Obama announced that he was going to change his vote on FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. He had said in January he would not sign a bill that granted telecom immunity for possibly warrantless spying on American persons. By the summer, in the middle of the general campaign, he said, I've thought about the issue more. I've changed my mind. I'm going to vote for this bill. And many of his own supporters on his own site went very publicly berserk. Within days of this group being created, it was the fastest growing group on mybo.com. Within weeks of its being created, it was the largest group. And Obama had to issue a press release. He had to issue a reply. And he said, essentially, I've considered the issue. I understand where you're coming from, But having considered it all, I'm still going to vote the way I'm going to vote, but I wanted to reach out to you and say, I understand that you disagree with me, and I'm going to take my lumps on this one. This didn't please anybody, but then a funny thing happened in the conversation. People in that group realized that Obama had never shut them down. Nobody in the Obama campaign had ever tried to hide the group or make it harder to join, to deny its existence, to delete it, to take it off the site. They had understood that their role with MyBo.com was to convene their supporters, but not to control their supporters. And that is the kind of discipline that it takes to make really mature use of this media. The media landscape that we knew, as familiar as it was, as easy conceptually it was as it was to deal with the idea that professionals broadcast messages to amateurs, right, is increasingly slipping away. In a world where media is global, social, ubiquitous, and cheap, in a world of media where the former audience are now increasingly full participants, right, in that world, media is less and less often about crafting a single message to be consumed by individuals. And it's more and more often a way of creating an environment for convening and supporting groups. And the choice we face, I mean anybody who has a message they want to have heard anywhere in the world, isn't whether that's the media environment we want to operate in. That's the media environment we've got. The question we all face now is, how can we make best use of this medium, even though it means changing the way we've always done it? Thank you very much.
You leave your audience with a question in your talk that I'm going to pose back to you. How can we make the best use of this media?
What I had gotten interested in between the first book on social media, Here Comes Everybody, and that talk and the subsequent book is the observation that you had lolcats, right? You have, you know, people doctoring up pictures of cute cats and mailing them around to crack each other up on their lunch breaks. And you also get Wikipedia, and you also get, you know, open source software. And you started to get, by the period I was giving that talk, you started to get and now visibly have all over the environment the most significant political questions conducted at the highest national levels, in part based on pressure from ordinary citizens. And I asked myself essentially, what's on that spectrum? And for all that getting large groups of people involved in campaigning for or pressuring politicians or governments in certain directions, the core to any of the really civically valuable stuff is a small group of highly committed people who are going back again to those tools today. The people who are obsessed with an issue, if we design power tools for them, they design the situations that can bring everybody else into the fold. So this is the beginning of Wikipedia, right? You have a small group of people who are committed to making the Wikipedia project as a whole work. And those people created a convivial environment for people writing about U.S. highways or the nature of asphalt or Doctor Who or the planetary system or whatever, who only care about their subject. They were given a platform by the Wikipedian self-conceived. And that pattern, I think, which we're not very good at, that's the pattern that makes this medium as civically useful as it can be, which is trying to figure out not how do we attract the average user, but really how do we design power tools for the obsessives and let them do that work of trying to attract the average user.
Clay Shirky is the author of Here Comes Everybody and
Cognitive Surplus.
Thank you so much, Clay.
Thank you.
You'll find several TED Talks by Clay Shirky and dozens more on social media, creative collaboration, and the power of crowds. Go to TED.com. Clay Shirky says you can see these kinds of collaborations taking place all over the world. A few weeks ago, after our interview, he told us about his recent trip to Norway, where he stumbled into a classic power of crowds moment.
Yeah, I was in Oslo by happenstance for a conference at the Folk Theater. During the festival, they said, okay, we're breaking for lunch, and some of you may want to go to the square for this mass sing-along. And I said, oh, really? What? You know, what is this? And they said that it was a protest that these two women had organized on Facebook.
Here's some background. In July 2011, a right-wing extremist named Anders Behring Breivik killed 77 people in Norway. In a country that small, it's estimated one in four people personally knew someone who was killed in that attack. Breivik went on trial in April 2012 and made a number of bizarre claims during his testimony, like how a popular children's song was brainwashing Norway's youth into Marxism. And he
I had a strong reaction to it because to me this is a song I hold so dearly. I grew up with it and I sing it to my own child.
Lill Univåg is a graduate student in Oslo and like a lot of Norwegians grew up singing this song. It's called Barna Rønbuen or Children of the Rainbow. It's actually an adaptation of a Pete Seeger song, My Rainbow Race. Lill couldn't believe Breivik was saying the song was bad for Norway.
I felt that he spoiled the song and I wanted to take it back.
So on April 20th, 2012, a Thursday, Lill got on Facebook with an idea to get a crowd of people together in a central square in Oslo and sing Children of the Rainbow together. She gave herself a week to organize and hoped by then she'd get 100 people to RSVP on the Facebook page.
It took about a couple of hours, I think. We were way beyond the 100.
Within a day of the Facebook posting, thousands of people had RSVP'd. Lill realized she was going to need some help. A friend told her to get in touch with a woman in town named Christina Barr, who works at a labor union.
Yeah, I saw it on Facebook on Friday night, and I decided, oh, I'm going to attend this. And I think it was 11:30 in the evening, I got the email from Lill asking if I wanted to help out. Of course, yes. I'm all in.
They put out the word to the singer, Lillebjørn Nilsen. He said he'd be there.
Everyone was tweeting about it as well, and it was all over the media. We were running from TV station to TV station to radio channel, and all the papers wrote about it.
Some employers gave their workers time off to go into the square and sing. Police estimated that the crowd could be as many as 10,000.
I think we started realizing that, okay, so maybe it could be 10,000, but we weren't really sure, and then instead 40,000 people shows up in Oslo.
Are they glad?
Not only the square was full, but the streets connecting to the square was jam-packed as well.
At least 40,000 people showed up to sing Children of the Rainbow, and the sing-along went viral. Smaller groups assembled in towns across Norway. Expats sang along with a live internet stream. Even Norway's prime minister tweeted about it.
I don't think we're exaggerating if I say that Norway stopped at 12 o'clock to sing.
It was a very clear message about the political will of tens of thousands of Norwegians about liberal values, which is what ultimately Breivik was attacking.
Since it was Clay Shirky who brought the story to our attention, let's let him have the last word.
They did not have to say, here is our specific 10-point program. They could say, essentially, if you share our goals and values, in any broad sense, turn out. I think the biggest lesson is really that when you frame a message in a way that isn't about raising awareness, but that is about taking action, the old gap between media and real-world action fades away. Your choice isn't either we're going to have a protest march or we're going to send out a brochure. Now there are ways in which you can send out a message that actually galvanizes real world action.
Usually, when we use the term crowdsourcing, we think of people coming together virtually over the internet. But now, let's meet a man who is relying on the power of crowds to help change the physical world.
Hi, my name is Marcin, farmer, technologist. I was born in Poland, now in the U.S.
Marcin Jakubowski is open sourcing a set of blueprints for 50 industrial machines that can be built cheaply from scratch. He believes with access to these tools, anyone can create a small, self-sustaining village. It will level the field, so to speak. Let's listen to more of Marcin's 2011 TED Talk, and then we'll talk to him.
So let me tell you a story. So I finished my 20s with a PhD in fusion energy, and I discovered I was useless. So I started a farm in Missouri. and learn about the economics of farming. I bought a tractor, then it broke. I paid to get it repaired, then it broke again. And pretty soon, I was broke too. I realized that the truly appropriate, low-cost tools that I needed to start a sustainable farm and settlement just didn't exist yet. I needed tools that were robust, modular, highly efficient and optimized, low cost, made from local and recycled materials that would last a lifetime, not designed for obsolescence. I found that I would have to build them myself. So I did just that. And I found that industrial productivity can be achieved on a small scale. So then I published the 3D designs, schematics, instructional videos, and budgets on a wiki. Then contributors from all over the world began showing up, prototyping new machines during dedicated project visits. And now the project is beginning to grow on its own. We know that open source has succeeded with tools for managing knowledge and creativity, and the same is starting to happen with hardware too. We're focusing on hardware because it is hardware that can change people's lives in such tangible material ways. If we can lower the barriers to farming, building, manufacturing, then we can unleash just massive amounts of human potential that's not only in the developing world. Our tools are being made for the American farmer, builder, entrepreneur, maker. We've seen lots of excitement from these people who can now start a construction business, parts manufacturing, organic CSA, or just selling power back to the grid. Our goal is a repository of published designs so clear, so complete that a single burned DVD is effectively a civilization starter kit. I've planted 100 trees in a day. I've pressed 5,000 bricks in one day from the dirt beneath my feet and built a tractor in 6 days. From what I've seen, this is only the beginning. If this idea is truly sound, then the implications are significant. A greater distribution of the means of production, environmentally sound supply chains, and a newly relevant DIY maker culture can hope to transcend artificial scarcity. We're exploring the limits of what we all can do to make a better world with open hardware technology. Thank you.
Joining us from Kansas City is Marcin Jakubowski. Hi, Marcin.
Hi, Allison.
I know that part of the concept of this global village construction set is about the practical needs for a small community, but there's also an element of economic equity to this, social justice. Can you explain that part of the project?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is not about creating a set of toys. This is about real life-size equipment that a community could use to provide food, housing, energy on the much more localized scale, focus being the economic significance, not just a set of toys.
What kind of machines and tools are you talking about?
So we've got everything from a tractor to an oven to a circuit maker, energy production equipment. There's a car, something that everybody understands, precision machining equipment, and everything in between.
I think when people think about crowdsourcing, they usually think about software, how it applies in that sense, not necessarily how it might apply to a tractor. When did you realize that crowdsourcing could be useful for something like farming equipment?
Yeah, well, I first coined the concept of open source ecology. It was back in grad school where I actually couldn't talk openly about my research because we had some hot material that we couldn't really share. And then I thought, well, what a waste. What if we could really collaborate on others in solving pressing issues and making products or whatever that may be? So while that's been proven in software, of course, the same kind of model can apply to hardware, i.e., it's simply about collaborative development where people are sharing openly. It's a natural, very, very natural extension of the software movement into real objects, which is much more complicated. But in the practice of that process, the principles are basic and the same.
To follow up on something you said, It's a little bit obvious, but I want you to spell it out for us. What is the direct relationship between open source and lowering the barriers of entry?
Yeah, the direct relationship is that when you're leveraging the power of true open collaboration, then people don't have to end up reinventing the wheel. They work together. It's a very, very simple concept. Can we do more by cooperating, or can we get farther by hiding things away and preventing others from doing the same, which is the standard way to do business today. It's about creating monopolies and getting competitive advantage by whatever means. That means you don't share. The IP issues are a huge one. But if you can address that by not being afraid to raise the bar for everybody when everybody cooperates, and therefore the products become better for everybody. So one argument one can make is that the present system as it is enforces mediocrity. There's only a few top players, but everyone else is kind of left behind. So the question becomes, well, what if everybody had access to the best design? Then we can go much further in benefiting everybody. So win-win situation.
Marcin Jakubowski, thanks for joining us from Kansas City, Missouri.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Marcin's machines, blueprints, and designs from the Global Village Construction Set. And find a link to his TED Talk. Go to ted.npr.org. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. On the show today, we're talking about the power of crowds. You think you know this movie, but are you sure?
Remember, the force will be with you always.
It won accolades and captured the hearts of people across the world, but it's not Star Wars. It's Star Wars Uncut.
Never heard of the Millennium Falcon.
Should I have?
It's the ship that made the castle run in less than 12 parsecs.
My name's Casey Pugh, and I made a project called Star Wars Uncut. I took the original Star Wars A New Hope and split it into 15-second pieces, and I asked the internet to recreate each scene however they wanted.
Did you hear that?
And I stitched it back together to recreate Star Wars, made by the fans.
The plans that you referred to will soon be back in our hands.
There's 473 scenes total. I think they literally covered every type of film style, animation, stop motion, claymation.
Darth Vader, only you could be so bold.
Backyard scenes.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Film noir.
The weapon of a Jedi Knight. An elegant weapon from a more civilized age.
Someone decided to make a scene as if Michael Bay had.
There's a droid on the scanner. Dead ahead.
The list goes on. When you give something to the internet, it's inherently going to become something completely different.
Casey Pugh. He won an Emmy Award in 2010 for his crowdsourced film, Star Wars Uncut. Imagine now you're in Grand Central Station. It's a typical day. The main concourse is bustling with people buying tickets, rushing to their trains, and then everything just seems to stop. A few hundred people scattered around the hall, just going about their business, all of a sudden freeze in place. It happened in 2008.
A couple was in the middle of kissing. There was three people posing for a photo. A man had just tripped and dropped a number of documents from his briefcase, and everything just came to a stop. And then 5 minutes later, they walked away.
That's Charlie Todd, the mastermind of this public display.
My name's Charlie Todd. I'm the founder of the group Improv Everywhere, which is a New York City-based prank collective that causes scenes of chaos and joy in public places. And my TED Talk was about Improv Everywhere, and the title of the talk was The Shared Experience of Absurdity. And I talked a lot about how when we create these sort of bizarre, absurd moments in public spaces, it gives complete strangers an opportunity to sort of have a shared experience with each other.
The inspirations for these come from all different places. There's one you did in where you took over some store windows, a lot of store windows.
Well, one day I was walking through Union Square and I saw this building, which had just been built in 2005. And there was a girl in one of the windows and she was dancing. And it was very peculiar because it was dark out, but she was backlit with fluorescent lighting. And she was very much on stage and I couldn't figure out why she was doing it. After about 15 seconds, her friend appeared. She had been hiding behind a display and they laughed and hugged each other and ran away. So it seemed like maybe she had been dared to do this. So I got inspired by that, looking at the entire facade. There were 70 total windows and I knew what I had to do.
What did you have to do?
I had to get 70 actors to take over all of these windows in this retail building. And I stood in the park, Union Square, which was across the street, and gave secret signals to all the participants. And that led them to do coordinated activities together. So you had everyone dancing, and then we had a dance solo where one person danced in one window and everyone else pointed at him. Other activities, including falling to the ground, doing jumping jacks, holding up 4-foot-tall letters that spelled out the name of the project, which was Look Up More. And that was sort of the theme, to give New Yorkers in Union Square, maybe heading to the subway or just heading home, the chance to stop and look up and notice something magical that was happening.
I wondered about the title of it because it did seem like it was making some sort of statement that we all are walking around with our heads down, looking at our little mobile devices or just trying to get where we want to go.
Exactly. And I'm as guilty as any New Yorker of that. I mean, I text and walk and I'm reading on my iPhone and listening to music on the subway. I feel like often, you know, the only time you would really engage with a stranger is if something negative was happening. So if you were in line at the post office and it was a really long line, like the person in front of you might like give you a knowing glance. But if you were at the post office and the line was moving really quickly, no one would ever turn around and go like, wow, great service today, huh?
Right.
So I like to create things that are so unusual and hopefully spectacular that it gives strangers a reason to communicate and share a smile and share something that is positive.
You also explained to the TED audience another very site-specific prank on an escalator at rush hour in Manhattan, which is a grim time.
And one morning I was riding the subway, I had to make a transfer at the 53rd Street stop where there's these two giant escalators. And it's a very depressing place to be in the morning. It's very crowded. So I decided to try to stage something that could make it as happy as possible for one morning. So this was in the winter of 2009, 8:30 in the morning. It's morning rush hour. It's very cold outside. People are coming in from Queens, transferring from the E train to the 6 train, and they're going up these giant escalators on their way to their jobs.
So I had 5 performers hold up signs along the stairwell, and it was sort of like the old Burma Shave signs where on the highway a message would play out over the course of several signs. So the first sign said, Rob wants. The next one said, to give you. Then a high five. Then there was a sign that said, get ready. And at the very top of the escalator, there was the final sign, which just said Rob and had an arrow pointing down to my friend Rob Lathan, who had his hand out, ready to give a high five. So in total, as people were going up the escalator, they read, Rob wants to give you a high five. Get ready. Here's Rob. And I spent a lot of time towards the top of the escalator watching. Almost everyone who left the escalator left with a smile on their face. Whether they were in the right spot to give the high five or whether they just watched from the other escalator, everybody was smiling.
The people who end up interacting with your pranks, it's victim isn't quite the right word, and they were not unwilling participant because you have to decide that you're going to laugh at whatever's happening or you're going to give the high five.
Right.
So it's this interesting way of getting people to engage. It's like a surprise engagement. I don't know what
you
call it.
Yeah. I mean, I think most of our projects, you know, there's sort of an invitation to be a part of them. And not everybody wants to be a part of them. We've had a subway car that's filled with 40 people in their underwear and someone who's reading the newspaper. But, you know, there'll be 10 other people who are laughing and taking pictures or even taking their own pants off. That happens occasionally, too, where someone will look around and realize, oh, I'm the only person with their pants on in this subway car. Like, I don't know what this is, but I'm taking mine off, too.
I'm joining the crowd.
Yeah.
I want to be part of it.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, ideally, we're trying to invite people in to enjoy an unusual moment together.
What practical things have you learned about crowds and what philosophical things have you learned about crowds from your pranks?
One thing I've learned is that it's really fun to be in a large crowd. I mean, I've always loved crowds. I remember as a kid going to football games at the University of South Carolina where I grew up and being in a massive stadium with 80,000 people and just simple things like doing the wave being so much fun. And I was always just like fascinated with it and I felt like most of the game, I was just hoping the wave would come back. But I think participating with the crowd and feeling like, oh, you know, this isn't just us cheering for something else or watching or spectating. We're doing this together. There's no right or wrong way to play. And you don't need a reason to come together and have fun.
You know, as kids, we're taught to play and we're never given a reason why we should play. It's just acceptable that play is a good thing. And I think that's sort of the point of Improv Everywhere, is it's that there is no point and that there doesn't have to be a point. We don't need a reason. As long as it's fun and it seems like it's going to be a funny idea and it seems like the people who witness it will also have a fun time, then that's enough for us. And I think as adults, we need to learn that there's no right or wrong way to play. Thank you very much.
Charlie Todd of Improv Everywhere, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Allison.
You can watch videos of Improv Everywhere's pranks and find links to Charlie Todd's latest exploits. They're at our website, ted.npr.org. Our last TED Talk tells the story of one man who has helped unite thousands of people around the world in perfect harmony, literally.
My name is Eric Whitaker. I'm a composer and a conductor, and my TED Talk was about the virtual choir.
Eric, can you explain the concept of the virtual choir?
I make a conductor's video. I'm conducting a piece of music that I've written, but no one is following me. I'm alone in a room. I upload that video to YouTube, and then singers from around the world individually upload their parts, singing along to my conductor track. All alone, they've never met. We get all of these parts together. They're all singing at the same tempo. We cut them together so that they all start at the same time, and it forms a choir, a virtual choir.
We'll talk more with Eric Whitaker in a few moments, but first, let's listen to his 2011 TED Talk, where he explains how he got the idea for the virtual choir.
Well, a couple of years ago, a friend of mine emailed me a link, a YouTube link, and said, "You have got to see this." And it was this young woman who had posted a fan video to me singing the soprano line to a piece of mine called Sleep.
Hi, Mr. Eric Whitaker. My name is Brentlyn Lucy, and this is a video that I'd like to make for you. Here's me singing Sleep. I'm a little nervous, just to let you know. If
Brittlin was so innocent and so sweet, and her voice was so pure. And I even loved seeing, you know, behind her, I could see the little teddy bear sitting on the piano behind her in her room. Such an intimate video. And I had this idea, if I could get 50 people to all do this same thing, sing their part, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, wherever they were in the world, post their videos to YouTube, we could cut it all together and create a virtual choir. So I wrote on my blog, OMG, OMG, I actually wrote OMG, hopefully for the last time in public ever. And I sent out this call to singers, and I made free the download of the music to a piece that I'd written in the year 2000 called Lux Aurumque, which means light and gold. And then as the videos started to come in, this is Cheryl Ang from Singapore. This is Evangelina Etienne. From Massachusetts. Stephen Hansen from Sweden. This is Jamal Walker from Dallas, Texas. And from the crowd emerged this young man, Scott Haynes, and he said, "Listen, this is the project I've been looking for my whole life. I'd like to be the person to edit this all together." I said, "Thank you, Scott. I'm so glad that you found me." And Scott aggregated all of the videos. He scrubbed the audio. He made sure that everything lined up. And then we posted this video to YouTube. This is Lux Aurumque, sung by the virtual choir.
we're speaking with composer Eric Whitaker about the creation of a virtual choir. For the radio audience, for the listening audience, can you please describe what that video looks like for people?
It's very cool and it's very disorienting at the same time because you see my little conductor video that I first made, and it's floating in space in front of these 185 other singers. And it looks like a choir might look if we were all Skyping together at the same time, which we're not, but that's basically how it looks, that we're floating there somewhere in this galactic church.
It was interesting to observe the audience at the TED Talk after the video played, because they were with you and trying to understand what was going on. And the minute they saw the video and heard it, it was like there was just a different energy in the room. And they got a standing ovation, and people suddenly had that aha moment. Oh, this is what it is? I wonder your thoughts on why you think it affects people so much when they see the video and they hear it, especially together.
I think people respond to it for a number of reasons. One, I think it's just beautiful to hear choral music. You know, it's the oldest instrument we have, the human voice. Then there's the poetry of all of these individuals across the world, alone. You can see them alone in their room and in their little videos, but they've somehow been brought together by the power of the internet, this new technology, so that we can be alone together. And it's such a striking poetic moment when you see that and then when you hear it. And finally, I think that it speaks well to a benevolent future for the internet. Technology, especially these days, it feels every day like it could go one way or the other, doesn't it? It feels like it could be bad, it could be good. And that this seems to be an example of just simply something pure and beautiful and human. And I think makes people feel a sense of wonderment about the technology, which maybe doesn't happen every day.
Eric, you decided to use your song Sleep for the next project, Virtual Choir 2.0. Let's go back to your TED Talk to hear about that.
And again, I posted a conductor video, and we started accepting submissions. And our final tally was 2,051 videos from 58 different countries. Thank you. This is Sleep, the virtual choir. We also put a page on Facebook for the singers to upload their testimonials, what it was like for them, their experience singing it. And I've just chosen a few of them here. My sister and I used to sing in choirs together constantly. Now she's an airman in the Air Force, constantly traveling. It's so wonderful to sing together again. I love the idea that she's singing with her sister. Aside from the beautiful music, it's great just to know I'm part of a worldwide community of people I never met before, but who are connected anyway. And my personal favorite, when I told my husband that I was going to be a part of this, he told me that I did not have the voice for it. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of you have heard that too. Me too. It hurt so much, and I shed some tears, but something inside of me wanted to do this despite his words. It's a dream come true to be part of this choir, as I've never been part of one. When I placed a marker on the Google Earth map, I had to go with the nearest city, which is about 400 miles away from where I live. As I am in the great Alaskan bush, satellite is my connection to the world. So two things struck me deeply about this. The first is that human beings will go to any lengths necessary to find and connect with each other. And the second is that people seem to be experiencing an actual connection. It wasn't a virtual choir that there are people now online, they're friends, they've never met. But I know myself too, I feel this virtual esprit de corps, if you will, with all of them. I feel a closeness to this choir, almost like a family.
Composer and conductor Eric Whitaker. He just completed Virtual Choir 3 with more than 3,700 videos from 73 countries. You can see and hear it on our website. Go to ted.npr.org. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Sam Greenspan, and Megan Kane. Special thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, and Darren Triff. Also, thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.